Take a network break, settle in with a virtual donut, and join us for our weekly dose of news analysis with a helping of informed cynicism. I'm Drew Conrymari. Greg Farrow is here. Today's show is sponsored in part by InterOptic. InterOptic offers high-performance, high-quality optics at a fraction of the cost. You can find out more at interoptic.com. And if you're attending InterOpt 2018 in Vegas, stop by their booth to learn how they can help you spec the right optics for your network. And don't forget that Tuesday, March 20th, the Packet Pushers are hosting a live online virtual design clinic. We've got a mix of independent and sponsored presentations that are going to tackle real-world network design challenges, and you can get details and register for free at packetpushers.net/VDC. Last but not least, please stay tuned after the news for a sponsored Coffee Talk conversation with Silver Peak. We're going to talk about SD-WAN and security, including privacy, firewalling, and integrating third-party security services.
Those little coffee breaks are really interesting, aren't they? It's always fascinating what we can get into in just 15 minutes of conversation.
It is kind of cool what we can pack in there to pat our own backs a little bit. But yeah, so check it out.
And InterOptic did a podcast a while back, and then the final wrap-up on the plugs is the Virtual Design Clinic, very exciting, next week, just a couple of days away. So make sure you register if you haven't already.
That's right. All right, to the news. The Open Networking Foundation, which you may know them for developing the OpenFlow standard, they've announced a new project called Stratum. Stratum is a software package for programming the switching data plane.
Very interesting, isn't it? It's like I've been saying that ultimately OpenFlow is the future, and I still think I'm correct, although I haven't ever explained that. Maybe one day I'll get to do a video on that and talk about it. So Stratum is an operating system to go on your switch. Now, it's unlike other open source projects that we've actually talked about, where we've had Broadcom open source their SDK. We've had other people talk about P4 in the forwarding path. This is the rest of everything that's in the switch. So the code that allows the system to boot, not the ONI, which is in the firmware, but the bit after that about what operating system to boot, the operating system itself, how it controls the fans and the FPGAs, how the chassis backplane runs, and also includes a P4 runtime and some basic operating functions for external administration. But if you want to put a CLI onto it, or if you want to put an SNMP, you have to go and find those and put them in yourself, right? So it's the core OS that allows you to do tables and ASIC and interface to the ASIC control engine, but that's it's not the whole thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out how to describe this, because I wrote a blog about it and I was really struggling with what to describe, because they're not calling it a network operating system. You still need a network operating system on top of it, or, you know, an external controller. But it is this layer that sort of sits in between the ASIC and an operating system to allow you to do some programmability of that pipeline.
Right. So it's got the tables. So the table management that sits in software, a common piece. There's no particular value in every inventor reinventing this wheel, if you know what I'm saying.
Exactly.
And then all the data that sits in the nodes, but it doesn't have the silicon SDK. That's provided by the vendor or third party. But it does include things like, how do I control the fans? What's my temperature? And it has stubs for thermal control and airflow and power supplies and all that sort of stuff. So if you're building an operating system, this is a key chunk around that.
That's right. And they talked about using P4 as part of it to sort of, they called it defining a contract about what the switch was capable of in terms of packet forwarding. And it sort of uses that as a definition to say, here's exactly what the switch can do. And if the switch is programmable, then we've also got P4 runtime if you want to make changes. And then they're using a couple of other tools that I think came from Google, GNAI, I think, which is a network management interface, and an operations interface also from Google. And in fact, the code itself for Stratum outside of P4 and P4 runtime is coming from Google as well.
That's right. So this is a step down the path to a genuinely generic operating system for devices. Mm-hmm. Remember, we talked about AT&T sort of throwing out them and putting, in theory, you know, making a commitment to put money behind it if I can find something in that thread. Well, this is another step down that direction. So Google's the progenitor of this code. It's coming from their organization itself.
From their production, the way they run their actual networks in production. Yeah, that's where this code's coming from.
But this isn't the whole thing. This is just part of the piece. So we still need, as I understand it, I don't think it's modules. I think it's actually an operating system, but it just doesn't have everything in there. So there's still no CLI. There's no SNMP. There's no syslog.
Right.
Because Google doesn't have any of that. Google just wants, it has its own custom operating interface that it uses to program the forwarding tables. And then what Stratum has done is strapped a P4 runtime onto this so that you could actually say, I'm going to update my forwarding tables via P4 commands. Okay, boom, done. But if you want to write your own REST API or your own Ansible module, there's no Ansible module for it yet, then you would have to do that yourself. But this is a substantial piece of this work. So writing an Ansible module so that you could configure it the way you want it, to, you know, anything coming in on this port goes at that port. That's a forwarding rule, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then You just write an Ansible module that generates the P4 and boom, you're away. Not an insignificant. Don't let me throw that out as something insignificant, but it's a lot easier than trying to write a module that runs on an operating system that loads the table into the ASIC, if you know what I mean.
Right. And we should say that the ONF, which is a foundation, is essentially run by giant service providers and telcos. So that's who they're aiming this at initially. That's going to be their initial consumers. But the list of partners who are participating in Stratum, Google's one of them, obviously. But then you've got folks like Broadcom. You've got Barefoot, which makes a programmable switch. You've got Big Switch. You've got some big telecom companies like China Unicom and others.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because you could combine this with Open Networking Linux. And now all we need is some snap-in stuff like Microsoft's SAI, switcher abstraction layer for the ASIC interface, mm-hmm. or for the vendors to step up and produce the SDKs and just to snap them in. And then all of a sudden we have a generic operating system. And now I think the key here is that there's an ecosystem play here. There's actually space for the vendors to build something around this.
That's right.
So the challenge with open source is if you actually replace everything, then there's no commercial space for the vendors to strap onto it.
Right.
to extract money. So they're not going to take it and then add their magic sauce to it, which means A, they don't invest upstream into the code itself, and B, they actively fight against its positioning in the market because it's going to disintermediate them and remove them from the market.
Right.
But this still leaves space above the stack for vendors to come along and start offering BGP interfaces, Ansible modules, command line interfaces, and other value-added things. So in theory, companies like Cisco or Juniper could strap their flavor of networking interface on top of this. So you could go and use your iOS CLI or your Junos CLI if that made you happy. Or you could, get an Ansible module to program it instead of, any other sort of thing.
And then at the other end of the stack, they are partnering with white box manufacturers and silicon makers like Broadcom and Barefoot, to actually have chips and boxes ready to run this as well. So it is a whole ecosystem.
And because it's service providers driving this, so enterprises won't be rushing off to get involved, I don't think.
Not at the outset, no.
Not at the outset. And what service providers want out of edge switches is very simple, right? They don't want the sort of complex.
They want to be able to customize their operations, hone it down to exactly what they need and be able to change it on the fly if they need to down the road. So that's why it's got deep ties to Onos, which is sort of a controller operating system, again, targeted at operators and service providers. But yeah, it's targeting for them first because they have very specific needs and use cases for it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the interesting thing here is where OpenFlow sort of disrupted the whole thing, it drove the vendors into a whole new model. Mm-hmm. I think the vendors sort of as much made sure OpenFlow went nowhere. So even though the vendors got engaged, they actually killed it as much because they didn't want it to disrupt their current revenue flows, right? They want to protect their profits.
Yes.
And I have the sense that, they killed it from the outside. It might be they killed it with love, but I think they actually, engagement also means killing it sometimes.
Yeah, so let me ask you about this. As it was in the back of my mind, we had a briefing from ONF about Stratum. We also got a briefing about Open Network Linux, which is another open source project. And both of them emphasized SDN, right, as a concept that they're behind and they're pushing. And that's not something that you and I hear about much anymore, particularly in regard to enterprise. It's almost like sort of a verboten now. You don't talk about SDN because it's so deeply tied to OpenFlow, which, had so much promise and then kind of fell on its face in the enterprise space that you don't hear people talk about SDN anymore. And yet, in this realm, folks are behind SDN.
You do, but we just don't call it SDN.
Like, that's what I mean. Yeah. They talk about intent, they talk about SD access, you talk about SD WAN, where it's, they don't say controller anymore, they'll say an orchestration platform or something. But the principles are still there. Just the tag SDN isn't used anymore, except in this realm.
No. Well, to some extent, when all the vendors piled into SDN because they didn't want to be left behind, it got massively abused.
Yeah.
Like SD-WAN as a concept has been massively abused. We've seen a number of, just straight out MPLS people with their networks add a software orchestration layer on the top of their legacy MPLS infrastructure and go, oh, we're SD-WAN because we've software defined our MPLS. And it's like, no, you people are so out of touch. Right? SD-WAN should never have an MPLS involved in it, right? As far as I'm concerned, if you're saying I've got MPLS somewhere in this, it's not SD-WAN. That's just MPLS with automation on top. That's how I see it, right?
There's definitely a lot of market abuse going on with SD-WAN.
That's right. Yeah. And that's normal. That's what companies do. They all don't want to die. They all want to protect their profits and, so forth and so on. And that's normal. Because when they're making money, they're also bringing value to customers, right? That doesn't stop me from being cynical about it. And it doesn't stop them from making bad decisions because money makes people make bad decisions. But the point here is that SDN is SD-WAN. SDN is what's happening in the data center. Simple things like Kubernetes and the way that it configures controller configures the networking stacks inside of those containers, SDN. You know, if you're looking at Nutanix and what Nutanix and Azure Stack are doing in their hyperconverged platforms, SDN, you know, as far as it goes. SDN didn't go away. It's just become a feature, not a product.
Right. Yeah. And the concepts are still valid. The concepts of disaggregation, the concepts of software-driven control, the concepts of wide-scale automation that SDN really pushed, those are still valid and viable. We're just not in the enterprise really calling it SDN anymore.
That's right. And I think the big thing about Stratum is ultimately that it shifts the focus to the controller, not the device. The device itself is a trivial part of an SDN system.
Which is why the legacy enterprise vendors hated that concept.
Well, I think they didn't want to let go. You know, when you've spent, you don't want to see your money just disappear out the door and then take the risk of phasing up to competitors. So if you've got control over your customers, which they do, or they did, maybe less now than they did, they can say to them, oh, you know, scary mystery, you know, spaghetti. Don't, you know, you need to be careful of that. That's mm-hmm. There's magic, you know. While they run around and try and find a viable strategy to cope with that. And sometimes the way that companies react is to actually just poo-poo it and make better buggy whips. And we saw Cisco do that for the first 3 or 4 years before they finally got dragged into the software-defined era. Now, whether that's going to be a thing going forward or not, I don't know. But, you know, SDN is everywhere. And then we know that Cisco does it because now they bought Viptela for SD-WAN. They put a software controller over the top of Lisp. And now they're putting... of course, they have ACI and they have a half a dozen others. They have some in the service provider space and, you know, they've got a bunch of other, they still support Open Daylight just in case that goes somewhere and so forth and so on. So.
Right. All right. Well, we could talk about Strata more, but let's move on because there is other news. But we've got links. If you want to learn more about it, go check it out. It's interesting stuff and a sign of the times of where network disaggregation is happening. But moving on, President Trump issued an executive order to block Broadcom's hostile takeover of chipmaker Qualcomm. The order cited national security concerns as the impetus for doing so.
Well, now, so obviously the first thing to note here is that Qualcomm is deeply entrenched in the U.S. political system. I read a post as I was researching this that Qualcomm is spending $100 million a year in lobbying in Washington, D.C., right? That's mm-hmm. an awful lot of money. Mm-hmm. And apparently Broadcom only spent about $100,000.
Ooh. Rookie mistake.
Yeah. So I think Broadcom was kind of betting on the fact, if you remember back just 6 to 8 weeks ago, Broadcom was moving its legal domicile from Singapore back to the US.
That's right.
Like when Broadcom and Avago merged, the actual physical headquarters was in the US, but they moved the legal domicile to Singapore to take advantage of the tax over there and get right. closer to the Chinese manufacturing plants, right? And especially with a lot of the manufacturing plants are in Taiwan. TSMC's facilities are there and Samsung's production facilities are there.
And I sort of remember when that news came out, I don't know if this is my imagination, but I remember seeing a picture of Broadcom's chief executive and Donald Trump sort of shaking hands and having a big smile about,
big news,
hey, we're
right?
moving to Delaware, which maybe the CEO assumed, and it's okay if I buy Qualcomm, right?
Yeah, obviously not, because Qualcomm's obviously gone to Trump and said, we need to support America and prevent this and, you know, something, lobby. And Trump's gone around and given Broadcom a kick in the balls, which is a bit unfortunate. So it's just a bit odd that that's happening. Now, keep in mind here, too, that Qualcomm is lobbying not just around this issue, but a lot of others. It lobbies extensively in Washington, D.C. to make sure that its intellectual property, its patent law is protected. And in the past, it has had. It's not Qualcomm is, although it's not real, it's about capitalism, it's as much about politics. And in the past, it has gotten substantial political gifts in the form of mandates for the FCC to use their technology. Do you remember CDMA before 3G when there was 2G? There was two standards and AT&T and Verizon's networks weren't compatible?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So AT&T was using Qualcomm's technology. And only Qualcomm owned those patents and they made the gear. And AT&T signed up to that technology and Verizon went and signed on to 3G.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Verizon's network was internationally compatible and AT&T's wasn't. And that, no, the other way around, sorry. Verizon had Qualcomm. And so whenever people went into the US, they were able to get onto AT&T's 3G network and Apple signed up. They didn't want to put Qualcomm technology in their phone. They didn't want to pay for it, and that killed off Qualcomm's dominance of that space in the US. But that technology was only picked up in the US, and as I recall, it was given there as a national security standard. They wanted to have two carriers using two different technologies. It was meant to be a national security issue. And Verizon went with the international standard, and AT&T bowed to the politicians and to Qualcomm and got locked in paying massive fees to Qualcomm. And so they've had a long history of, you know, getting their patents into products via politics, not via just being better or smarter. So this isn't a surprise that they decided they didn't want to be taken over. They went to the government. They did some lobbying. They got Trump's ear and got what they wanted. They didn't want to be taken over. Now, the interesting question is, what happens to it now? Once a company gets into play for a takeover like this and gets rebuffed from its primary suitor, does somebody else come in and sweep it up?
That's right. And I did see a couple of stories about Intel maybe scratching its beard like,
Yes. Well, we've already said in previous shows that Intel's having a bit of a struggle at the moment. Obviously, DRAM prices are up. Manufacturing problems are – we saw server prices this week. There were some reports published from IDC talking about server revenues are up a lot, but profits aren't, and that's because it's DRAM pricing going up, not actually profit margins or sales volumes going up, right? It's just the DRAM pricing because they just can't manufacture enough. Now, Intel could look, and you know, obviously with their losing dominance in the smartphone market, Intel could look to buy Qualcomm, who is dominant in the smartphone market. And on the face of it, you know, when you talk about $50 to $100 billion deals, it does. There's a certain logic to it. So it's possible.
Although keep in mind, Reuters is also reporting that Broadcom's still planning to move forward with redomiciling to the United States. So it would officially be a U.S. company. So if and when that happens, it could potentially come after Qualcomm again. So interesting times ahead.
I do think that if they didn't follow through on that commitment, I do think that the current political climate, there'd be unpredictable reactions to that.
Certainly, certainly.
Yeah. So, but not, you know, and it's also highly unusual for a U.S. president to get involved in these types of things. It's not normal for a U.S. president to get involved in what is fundamentally a corporate or for capitalism or just free markets. So that's an interesting fact.
It is, although there's also a Bloomberg story that has a list of executive orders that Trump has issued blocking certain deals. And there was a long list. Most of the companies that he was preventing buying were Chinese-based companies trying to buy U.S. companies. But it isn't the first time it happened, but this is definitely the biggest one we've seen in this administration so far.
Yeah. So it could be interesting to see how this shakes out. One thing to note is that in the financial results that Broadcom published yesterday, that they must be very pleased they bought Brocade because that business is now producing them, is now up to $1 billion worth of revenue, and that's up 40% since they got a hold of it.
Not bad.
That's not bad. So they've managed to juice that storage business up to a whole new level. So yay for Fiber Channel, I guess.
Hey, there you go. Wow. All right, moving on. A major VMware shareholder is publicly opposed to a proposed reverse merger with Dell Technologies. If you remember, we talked about Dell Technologies looking to maybe go public, and one of those, they could do an IPO, or they could sort of reverse merger with VMware and come out public through VMware. But now an investment firm called Jericho Capital Asset Management put out a public letter saying that this reverse merger would saddle VMware with debt and wreck its growth. I've got a quote here from the letter, and it's pretty stunning. It says, quote, VMware gains nothing by saddling the company's faster growth, net cash, highly strategic software business with the dead weight of Dell's slower growth, heavily debt-laden, legacy, hardware-dependent entity. Ouch.
See, one of the things I've talked about is I have this broad premise going on in the market that investing in enterprise IT companies is a dead-end game. And so you want to get your money out of them. You want to get whatever return. So you want to move your capital to somewhere in a market which is getting higher returns, and that's called capital efficiency. That's why we have markets. If a business starts to slow down or go wrong, then you pull your money out and you invest it somewhere else, and that's what free markets are supposed to achieve. The capital goes where it's going to give the best return to society as a whole.
In theory
to society down the pipeline. And so the point that this person's trying to make is, look, Dell's a dead business. It's an old IT dinosaur. It's an enterprise IT dinosaur. VMware, however, has got a chance of moving into the cloud. And if you stuff it, Dell inside of it, it's going to die. Well, the flip side of it is that Dell owns VMware outright. Mm-hmm. In reality, they own 90% of the voting shares.
Yeah. So if they want to stuff it dead, they can.
Yeah. That horse has bolted. You know, when the market bought VMware shares and they had no voting rights, it doesn't really matter what you think. And any amount of protestation will go absolutely nowhere. I think the problem here for customers who are listening here, they should be thinking to themselves, while Dell is off playing financial fiddlyjinks, they could be losing control of the core business. The risk here is that Dell takes its eye off the ball to run around and do financing and deals. The same thing happened to Dell when it was taking over EMC. It took its eye off the ball, things slowed down, and it took a couple of years for, you know, for executives to then focus on driving the business and tightening up, you know, blah, blah, blah. And as the deals get bigger and more unusual and there are more problems to solve, it's much more likely that the core business will lose control and focus. So doing these if they do the reverse merger into VMware, it's a tricksy-dixie deal that's going to require all sorts of, you know, hassle and annoyance and embuggerance. Customers should be looking for these companies to come off the rails when there is a good chance they are. So you'd be looking for things like VMware, Cloud Foundry, the RSA, you know, the other children of Dell that are not in, but they're actually fully owned by Dell. They're the ones that you should be looking to be in trouble as the executives take their eyes off the ball to go off and play, you know, games in the stock market.
All right, keep that in mind as you make your purchase decisions. Take a quick moment to talk to you about our sponsor today, Interoptic. Demand from the edge, 5G and IoT are coming, and if you're not doing optics correctly, you're going to pay for it later. Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and they support the full range of products that you need today and maybe don't yet know that you need tomorrow. So stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to the experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by lesser optics. The difference between generic third-party and brand equivalent optics matters. You can purchase the same, if not better, performing optics at a fraction of the cost, and they are designed by engineers who truly understand what you need. So take control of your optics purchase with Interoptic. You can go to interoptic.com to get more details, and if you happen to go to Interop 2018 in Vegas, stop by the Interoptic booth and learn how they can help you spec the right optics for your network. Back to the news. Intel has announced that new chipsets are expected to start shipping in the second half of 2018, and they will be free of Spectre and Meltdown vulnerabilities.
Interesting. I mean, this, my cynical button just went like all the way out, just popped off the board out. You know, so the Spectre Meltdown thing has been around. Like Intel, Google identified it a long time ago, like a year, 15 months ago, maybe half a year, year and a half ago. And for a hardware fix to come into place, like fixing CPUs, redesigning CPUs that should have been locked down by now, do you have the sense that Intel prioritized the hardware fix?
Yes.
Yes, right?
I do.
So this seems like a really suspiciously fast response to the Intel, you know, to the Spectre Meltdown issue. They've had, you know, a year to 18 months to come up with a hardware. And it sounds, I get to skip the fence that Intel started to fix the hardware problem immediately, but just sort of let the software go like, yeah, whatever. We've already got the money for those things. Why are we bothering? And then when they shift those software patches, they were buggy and badly done, and then they had to pull them back twice. I think the third version's actually out there now if other people haven't solved it one way or the other.
All right, so let me see if I get what you're saying here. You're saying word came to Intel, hey, these processes that you're using in your hardware are vulnerable and we have proof, and so Intel immediately in its next hardware design started fixing that and then sort of let the software side, which they would need to serve customers to fix existing products, they sort of let that slide until the news came out and suddenly they were under a lot of pressure?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Right? Okay.
So what you're doing here is if you're a corporate company, what you want is to protect your future revenues, right? Those CPUs have already been sold and that money's been booked.
That's true. That money's out the door, yeah.
That money's out the door, right? There's no maintenance revenue or anything. There's just brand. And the answer is most of the people are captive in the x86 market. So what's the most important thing to do? Isn't to run a shared software patch and keep the customers safe. It's to get the next generation of CPUs fixed.
Uh-huh.
Right? I just feel like Intel's got the wrong goals here. Your customers have to be safe and have to be happy, and they should have done something about the software. They should have put the best resources onto the software part.
Yeah, when I read the story, and there, I'll have a link to the story from the Register on our website and also a note from Intel CEO about what they're doing, my thought was Intel's like, please, can we turn this page? Please, can we turn this page? Let's start talking about the new chips. Please, can we turn this page? And they also noted they have issued microcode updates for 100% of the products from the last 5 years that are vulnerable to Spectre and Meltdown. But really, they were saying, let's look to the future. Don't worry about the millions of chips that are out there in production right now.
Yeah, we know we sold you faulty chips. Just go and buy some new ones.
That's right.
Rubs yeah. Hands together. You know, you'll have to buy new ones to take the bug out. Oh, well, more money for us. You know, yeah. I know that's probably not exactly the truth, but you do just get the feeling that, and it's just a natural. And again, this is where big companies do stupid things without even meaning to. You know, it is actually a fix that really the only way out of this, I think, in the end, is to actually, you know, buy new CPUs. But this just feels a little heartless, you know, to me. When they fluffed the software fix, they should have had a software fix, even if it was performance impacting, got it out there, anybody could have it, and done a good job of that at the same time as doing this. They really have the resources and the profits they should have been able to do.
I agree. All right, moving on. Security vendor Palo Alto Networks is acquiring the cloud security company Evident.io for $300 million. Evident monitors AWS and Azure for security flaws, vulnerabilities, and compliance requirements, and they also give you a dashboard to help you track your flaws and risks.
So the first thing I thought about this was Palo Alto is finally making some moves to be a cloud company. Mm-hmm. They've made a bang-up job of turning, you know, a firewall into an application firewall, into some sort of security appliance that everybody wants to buy, which is, you know, good job. I think really picking up on the failure of Cisco to get into that space. I think Palo's headed into being bigger than Cisco. I think I saw a press release this week saying they're going to be bigger than Cisco Security, which is an amazing feat, really. Evident, however, is not a firewall. It's a straight-out security tool. That is, it's a cloud auditing tool. So it actually, it's a platform that sits on top and pulls all of the APIs out of your cloud platforms, looking for common mistakes in your configuration of your cloud. So really, this is moving Palo Alto out of the firewall game into a security business, a much more generic security company.
I mean, we regularly hear things like unsecured S3 buckets that are publicly available on the internet. So it sounds like Evident is one of the companies trying to help you fix that problem. I think it's smart of Palo Alto to diversify. You know, they made their name as perimeter threat detection, and they can ride that market for as long as they can. But having a cloud, generic cloud service, is not necessarily about firewalling, but about security and compliance makes sense to me.
Yeah, and I just feel that, you know, at the end of the day, we can't trust a developer. We always have to have an independent security thing. And in the cloud, you can't actually provide some sort of perimeter. There is no perimeter.
Right.
So the only way you can do it is to start ripping into the configurations and start doing analyze that. So you can't trust the developer to do what they're told, or that they'll do what they said they would do, or that they were, you know, that they actually got it right. So you do always need an independent verification. And so Evident is really into this auditing. But auditing manually doesn't work, so it has to be automated auditing or software-defined auditing.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, an SDN for security auditing, and that's exactly what it does. So it'll be interesting to see where they take this, because obviously the logical extension of this is that you could start adding their own firewalls into it and looking for common mistakes, like, is there a firewall rule in here that's unused? Then I could take it out. Mm-hmm. Is there firewall rules here that don't do what they're supposed to do, or there's a common errors, you know, we could tell you that this shouldn't be here. There's a common mistake. So, yeah.
Would you like to upgrade your security to include a virtual firewall in this cloud, in this VPC, that kind of thing? Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yes, exactly.
And we just happen to have one that you could buy with a click of the button.
Yes, that's right. From our cloud, you know, you won't even have to install anything. Click here.
That's right. There's no moss growing on Palo Alto. They know what they're about. All right, quick break to tell you about our Packet Pushers Virtual Design Clinic coming up Tuesday, March 20th. And if you're listening to this episode the day it debuts, that's the Monday. So the Virtual Design Clinic is tomorrow. So if you haven't signed up yet, please do. Greg, you can tell us a little bit more about what's going to happen.
So this is our attempt to have a conference over the internet. What we really want to do is get away from this idea of traveling and getting, you know, getting all the hassle of getting approved to travel and the family damage and the personal life damage, and just hold conference quality events online with the sort of content that you get from a conference, but made available to you now. We've got independent speakers. We've got people like Matt Oswald and Peyton Maynard Quaran coming on to tell their stories about automation. And we've got some sponsors from Glueware and ThousandEyes who are coming in to talk about their ways of automating different parts of the network and getting visibility. Plus, we're going to have 2 hours of interaction, so you'll be able to get into chat rooms and talk to other people who are doing networking. And while the event is on, the chat rooms will be active and you'll be able to ask questions live. People like Ethan and myself and a team of Packet Pushers friends will be there patrolling them to make sure that that everybody behaves well and that there's also people to answer those questions as best they can and promote the discussion. And best of all, it's free. So it's online and it's free. So it'll be on Tuesday, the 20th of March, starts at 10 a.m. Eastern U.S. time. Watch out for the changeovers. It's here in the U.K. It's non-changeover week. That's next week. And then blah, 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 all the things. So just watch out for that. But 10 a.m. Eastern on Tuesday, March the 20th, we'd love to see you there. Head on over to packetpushers.net/VDC. There's more details there, and you can register it right there. You can say, just sign up very quickly. The sign-ups basically just send you an email to remind you where you are and click here to join the GoToWebinar platform. We don't abuse your details, so we won't be emailing you. We won't be harassing you. It's literally just there to give it to GoToWebinar because we have to have a webinar platform.
We do have an opt-in option if you want to get information from sponsors, but you actually have to opt into that. The default setting is opt out. So yeah, we won't be bugging you. Head on over to packetpushers.net/VDC to get details and sign up. All right, back to the news. Major U.S. tech firms like Google, Facebook, and Amazon potentially may face a new 3% tax from the European Union. That's according to a story in Reuters. The new tax is meant to address efforts by tech firms to avoid taxes by moving profits to lower tax countries like Luxembourg or Ireland.
Yeah, that's right. So they start them off in Ireland, move them to Luxembourg, and then up to Holland for the double Dutch sandwich, and then out. to a tax-free location.
A tax-free two-step.
The point here, I think, for me, is that ultimately the governments have to react to this because these companies are extracting vast amounts of revenue from economies in Europe and other around the world, and they're not paying any tax. So they get access to the entire infrastructure of the country that they're operating in without contributing towards it. And so this is the first step down that path. It's quite a ways away. And it's something that I've been saying has to happen over time. If this continues down the path, then it's going to impact both the US and the Chinese IT vendors because they are both extracting a lot of, like, the Europe hasn't got a strong base for, you know, these technology companies to emerge and dominate the market. The capital is in the US and in China. So it's definitely going to change the way they operate if they have to start paying 3% on turnover. Not profit, turnover. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how this comes out because it will change business models. Obviously, it's targeting people like Google, Facebook, and Amazon who pay effectively zero tax. They get, for all the money they take out of the economy, they effectively pay pittance. And so I think this is a good move, but it does have impacts to infrastructure, IT infrastructure generally, because those companies will actually have to start making more money or take less profits. And I'll be interested to see which way they go.
That's right.
All right, our last story for this episode. You remember that massive Equifax breach exposed the personal details of 143 million people? Well, it turns out that an executive named Jun Ying, he's been indicted on charges of insider trading by a federal grand jury that he sold stock before the breach was announced.
Yeah, this is interesting because he didn't actually know. But he was able to prove that he didn't know what was happening. But what he actually worked out was that he wasn't in the loop and wasn't informed, but when he saw it online and saw hints of it coming out in the press, what he did was ran out to get advice on how many shares he can sell and then ditched all of them.
Apparently, he sold almost $1 million worth of stock, yes.
Mm-hmm. But he sold it on the rumor.
Right? It was before the breach was announced, yes.
That's right. So he works at a public company. It suffered a breach. It wasn't publicly announced. He didn't know. So it wasn't illegal insider information, but he sort of did insider guessing.
Mm-hmm. Based on the story I read, he wasn't directly told, but he may have picked up on hints or scuttlebutt within the organization.
That's right. So he sort of saw the coming. And anyway, so exercised all of his vested options to buy Equifax shares and then immediately sold those Equifax shares for total proceeds of more than $950,000, avoiding $117,000 in losses that he would have faced after the breach was made public. What's interesting here is that when you get into these gray areas of law in the US legal system, they normally go on the side of the free market. In the other words, this person wasn't culpable. But in this case, they've actually decided to get after him and punished him, which is interesting.
Right. He also, after the transaction was disclosed to Equifax, he and Equifax agreed to part ways.
Yeah. This is one of those times when it doesn't matter what you did. It's what looks bad.
Right. And Equifax already looks bad.
Yeah. Funny how Brian Krzanich, who's the CEO of Intel, sold all of his options just before. But he seems to have been, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Sometimes. And I think ultimately a lot of those people in Equifax were going like, you know, who wants to be around to clean up this mess? It was all easy before. And now all of a sudden it's going to get hard. Well, I don't want to be here. That's too much like hard work. Get the hell out. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have a link to that story.
All the people in charge of Equifax were pretty incompetent. Really.
Yeah. I could do a whole show about how I feel about them, but just insert your favorite curse words and we'll be done with it. All right. That wraps up the news portion of today's show. Please stay tuned for a coffee talk with Silver Peak. We're going to be talking about SD-WAN and security. That's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk, a short sponsored conversation to help you get up to speed on new technologies and ideas in about the time it takes to drink a coffee. Today, we're talking about security and SD-WAN with our sponsor, Silver Peak. Our guest is Rolf Meralt. He's VP of Product Management at Silver Peak. Rolf, welcome to the show. So when we talk about SD-WAN, most of the time we focus on connectivity, about combining private and public links to send traffic over the most appropriate link based on business policy, etc. Today, we're going to be talking about security. So I'm curious, what does SD-WAN bring to the table? If I'm thinking about a typical branch office, maybe I have a VPN, I have a firewall, maybe malware detection or something. What's SD-WAN's role here? Are we talking about augmentation, replacement, something else?
Hey, Greg, good to catch up. Let's maybe start with the VPN aspect. So the old NetOps saying used to be VPNs are great when they work. And so the main three reasons why they generally don't work really have to do with the scalability aspects. And so when you set up these point-to-point connections, and you have 1,000 sites, right, you might end up with 1 million tunnels. You're not going to be able to manage that manually. And so the security challenges that we see with sort of box by box configuration of VPNs is when you have different generations of administrators that go in, make some changes, leave. How do you go about actually making sure that any given business intent that you have for your network as a whole is actually translated to these individual box-by-box configurations?
We call that configuration rot. So over time, like when you're running a mesh, you know, like even a point-to-point IPsec network, you've got ACLs all over the place and crypto configurations and things like that. And
exactly.
As you go through different administrators, you get this rot where people just keep adding access lists in or deleting access lists or putting overlaid access lists, and things just rot. The configuration literally rots over a period of time.
I love the term. And in a lot of cases, people will buy a new router because they've ran out of the X hundred of ACLs that you can put in, and they could probably remove a lot of these, but they don't know which ones to go touch and they don't want to do that. So they buy a new router, right? And so it's really kind of brain dead when you think about it. And so the SD-WAN obviously makes that a lot better because now you have this policy engine, you have a central place, a single screen where you can go and sort of describe for a certain application or group of applications, what are the paths that it's allowed to take. So for security, obviously that path is going to include an inspection device, a firewall. So maybe we'll get back to that in a second. But the other aspect I wanted to mention that you made me think about with this ACL comment is, when you set up VPNs, it's very it's doable to traverse NAT devices. It's very, very hard to traverse NAT and port address translation devices. And the reason for that is that most VPNs rely on the IKE protocol, and there's sort of well-known ports that need to be non-translated between the two. So the SD-WAN on top of that gives you a lot more flexibility in building tunnels across NAT. We can go through PAT, we can go through CG, carrier grade NAT, right? So there is a lot more situations where you can now deploy tunnels where you would not have been able to do that manually.
And I think it's important also to consider that for many people, an IPsec is always a point to point. So it's always from the branch to the core, because running partial mesh or full mesh is actually, well, very complicated to operate. And even if you shift up to tools like DMVPN or some other form of quasi-proprietary VPN, you have these scaling issues, but you also have security problems, because to get this any-to-any connectivity, you're actually compromising the security king because you have to key off the... So using a controller actually makes the actual encryption much more secure. And we take that a step further, and it's also about PKI and the actual crypto management itself, key rotation, simple things like key rotation.
That's right. And so we can obviously have policies that are, there's default policies. So by default, we rotate the keys every 24 hours. This is something that the customer is free to configure. But again, it's done from a central place. And the other part where the VPN was really very limiting was it's a single pipe, right? It's kind of this one size fits all pipe. Whereas when you connect branch users to their applications and these applications are moving from the data center to the cloud, you may have a very different policy you want to associate with an application that is Office 365 versus Netflix versus some GitHub or some other applications where you actually want to inspect the traffic to see whether by mistake maybe some key files are getting uploaded. And so the ability of the SD-WAN to not only take you out of the business of doing box-by-box configuration, but being able to slice the network horizontally, and so we commonly call that segmentation or micro-segmentation, and that is something that is tailored to the application and the business's intent for how that application should be managed.
Yeah. And really, access lists, we only configured them manually because it wasn't worth writing a piece of software to build those things, right? Or the reason that we did IPsec the way we did was because, you know, we were only doing a few of them. And this is that scale point you're talking about. When you're configuring thousands of IPsec endpoints in a mesh, partial or full, and dynamically setting them up, turning down, you actually get beyond the actual capabilities of the command line or a person or even a group of people to keep that together. And I think that's where it is. But I think the other side about what SD-WAN brings to the table, and particularly Silver Peak, is this concept of application security. Because you recognize the application, suddenly your security posture is really transformed, I think.
That's right. So if I were to ask you the question, Greg, how secure is your network? Your answer probably isn't going to be, it's not going to be a number of firewalls, right? So increasing the number of firewalls as you're adding more internet connections to your branch offices because you want to be able to drop the traffic locally and have a better path to Office 365 or your other business applications. Generally, the most secure way of doing that isn't just going to be to throw more firewalls at the problem. And part of the issue is the configuration drift that we talked about. And so when we looked at what is kind of the new WAN-edge and what does it look like in terms of simplifying security configuration, we took a bit of a hybrid approach of using both a best of breed partnership. So we were partnered with Zscaler, with Palo Alto, with Fortinet, with Checkpoint, so that if you own these security assets, we can automate the service chaining of that firewall into the path of the application that it is relevant for. So we can sort of take away the physical cabling pieces that you used to have to do to be able to get traffic to flow to the right security asset. And so it's really more about orchestrating the appropriate combination of local, cloud, and data center located security devices.
But when you talk about breakout at the local branch, it's different, right? You're not saying, oh, this IP range at this can go out to the internet pipe and the rest can go this way. And it's more than a stateful firewall. You're actually genuinely recognizing the apps. So you recognize Office 365, you recognize Dropbox, you recognize Google Mail, right? And you say, don't route that down to the head office. Don't route that down to my private cloud / data center. Send it out local. But the destinations could be any IP address. I mean, these companies have dozens of ranges, you know, or hundreds of IP address ranges that they may or may not use.
That's correct. So on a daily basis, the Office 365 IP address for a given service, whether it's email or it's Word, is going to change. And so people in the past have attempted to sort of break out some of this traffic locally by hard coding, using an ACL, right? Hard coding an IP address, as you described. But then that address is going to change. So you've just created this impossible long-term liability, right, for your company in terms of trying to keep that up to date. So what we did a couple of years ago was we invested a lot of time and engineering into technology that we call First Packet IQ. And it was really out of the recognition that as more and more of your traffic is HTTPS encrypted traffic, trying to throw a DPI engine at that traffic and getting certificates to decode and be able to recognize the app within the packet isn't going to work.
Aren't going to get the private keys to Office 365 so you can decrypt that and see what's going on, right? That's not happening.
Exactly. So what we did instead was we essentially looked at it from the basic steering visibility and control point of view of if we could build a map of the internet where each IP address was mapped to given service at any point in time, and we could track that change, right? So there's an element of machine learning. We can talk a little bit more about that later. That goes into how the technology works. If we had such a map, then as soon as we see the destination IP address of an HTTPS flow, we will be able to say this is Netflix versus this is Office 365. And so we can steer it to a different firewall policy. We do have a simple stateful built-in firewall that is part of the Edge Connect device. And so for a lot of trusted business critical applications such as Office 365 or other SaaS applications, Workday, etc., you can leverage that built-in firewall. And then for some of the other applications like GitHub, where you want to do actual logging or inspection, we can then recognize that application and immediately from the first packet on, and it's very important that you do that from the first packet on, steer it to a data center hosted best of breed firewall from Palo Alto.
Yeah. So you might have a policy. What we recognize is that people have, well, existing prejudices, I guess, sometimes. They believe that a certain brand of product is actually a firewall. I personally believe that anything's a firewall. An access list is actually a firewall according to the official definition. Why? Because there is no official definition. You can define anything to be a firewall, right? And it's important to understand that the security posture defines what type of firewall you want to have or what type of security posture you want to have. If you just want to put up a simple barrier, then an access list is fine. But really, we need to be saying, I don't want to filter an IP address. That doesn't fly anymore. It's about filtering an application. I want to prevent anything with this certificate from doing that, this SSL cert, or I want to prevent anything that I recognize from going to Salesforce. Maybe you've decided to stop using Salesforce, so you want to block your people from accessing that service, so you want to block that provider going forward so that they don't keep using a dead service. You can do all of those things, which is not something you can do with traditional networking.
That is exactly right. So the key is we need to be at the application level, right? Layer 7. And at that point, right, is it DPI? Is it machine learning of IP addresses? Or is it ACLs? Doesn't maybe matter quite as much, but you have to be all granular. And so maybe just give you a quick customer example. In the UK, so in your backyard, Nuffield Health, healthcare organization with about 20,000 users across 260 sites in the UK. Their application for these technologies was really that they found their main SaaS applications are TrackCare, which is a electronic medical records application, and Office 365. And so they found that they had an MPLS network. They were backhauling this traffic. The performance and user experience was quite poor for their sites to go to these applications. And so what they wanted to do was be able to say, if it is Office 365, if it is TrackCare, I want this traffic dropped locally at my branch. I would like to use the built-in Edge Connect firewall to do this because these are my trusted applications. But I also want to enable my users to be able to access some other sites for personal use. And for those, I'd like to leverage a cloud firewall. And so it turns out Nuffield Health is a Zscaler customer. And so for that class of traffic, I would like you, Edge Connect, to immediately steer it to my cloud firewall sites, so across a number of points of presence. And then for the unknown applications that didn't fall into these two buckets, I still have two data centers where I have some Palo Alto Network firewalls, and I want those to be put in the path of that traffic. So I call it stitched into the path of that application traffic. And they can control that literally with drag and drop from a single screen. And so you can build kind of this service chain of connections and security devices. I can kind of create a resource pool for my Palo Alto Networks firewall, so I can drag that into the path of my other applications. I have my built-in firewall, and so I can describe this literally in a very kind of UI-driven, graphical user interface-driven drag-and-drop manner. And if Office 365 changes its IP addresses, it will still work, right? So that's the beauty of it. Once you've done the policy, you're not going to have to.
But you're also still getting logging. So Zscaler doesn't just give you, you know, it knows who's accessing where. It logs that they did. Zscaler is able to coordinate. These cloud security companies can bring together data sources from thousands of customers and use machine learning to work out who's what. So now Nuffield has the ability to see who's accessing Office 365 and many other details, and to log the fact of what accesses were done and things like that.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And the tunneling, right, to these points of presence, this is something that you can do from a branch site. You can choose to have, which is Nuffield's case. So they've migrated now off of MPLS, and each site is connected to dual broadband ISPs, so separate ISPs. This orchestration of the connectivity between the branch and the cloud firewall, you can describe in the policy that you want to leverage these two paths. And so we built two separate tunnels, which extend each branch to the appropriate point of presence within Zscaler, so that if one ISP fails, you have the other one and you still have the same connectivity. So all of these different security and transport pieces really just become resources that you can describe from a policy point of view. And as I said, kind of literally drag and drop into the description of the policy. It's not that the central policy is something you need to write up like a constitution, but it's something that you can really do from a very graphical way. And you can obviously also get the metrics. So we have dashboards that will show exactly how much of your traffic is broken out locally versus sent to cloud firewalls or on-premise firewalls.
So just to wrap all this up then, you're talking about the capability to use a built-in stateful firewall at the Edge Connect device. You can also send traffic based on policy to a cloud security service, Zscaler. And a third case, you can send it to a data center running a Palo Alto or some other firewall, hardware firewall brand. And all of this policy, all of this configuration is happening centrally. It's not like I have to go out to each branch device and do all the stitching that you mentioned. It all happens centrally.
That's exactly right, Drew. So essentially, your segments that you're able to form on a per application or category of application basis extend into your security posture, because chances are that your security posture for your business critical apps or your voice and video real-time apps or your other apps is going to be something slightly different. And so that same concept of segmentation very beautifully extends end to end, including into the LAN side of your branch and data center. And so we can essentially extend that segmentation across your data center overlays as well, if you will.
So Rolf, this brings us about to the end of this segment. If folks want to get more information, where can they go?
Thanks, everybody. So basically, we have a YouTube channel, which is Lightboard with SolarPeak, that has excellent explanations of how different technologies work, both from a service chaining and from a inspection point of view.
All right, so head on over to YouTube, do a search on SolarPeak, and you'll be able to find all kinds of good videos. And we'll also have links in the show notes with lots of information from SolarPeak. Rolf, thank you for joining us, and thanks, SolarPeak, for being a sponsor. And of course, thank our listeners for joining us. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and of course, rate us on iTunes. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.